Without further ado, I would like to start the speaker list. So George Blood will be our first speaker at the symposium, and we'll talk about bits as bits, or maybe they aren't.
Maybe not. Yeah.
First point I want to make is that the study that I'm going to talk about is the results of the process we went through qualifying new systems at our facility. We had been running an old-style sneaker net system of moving hard drives between computers as it moved through production, and we installed a storage area network and started qualifying the systems. And what we found during that qualifying process is what we is what I'm going to be talking about. This is to differentiate from a more systematic study where we look at different systems and compare them. For our purposes, it was sufficient to find a system that worked rather than to try to figure out the limitations of any given system. But this describes how we found various configurations of hardware and software working out of the box. So if we take this as a starting point, this is just a schematic design of a classic playback system for analog audio. A lot is known about the analog components. A lot is discussed about the analog to digital conversion. There's a lot we can do with the management of the assets once we have them in files, and we know the challenges of dealing with the physical carriers over time. What we're going to do is look at this part of the chain, that area as the bits leave the analog to digital converter and then they're written to the files. What happens in that stretch? And there's quite a bit of handling of the data in that time. Every system will be somewhat different, just trying to make the point that there's a lot of places where that data is handed off, both in cabling and switching in the physical layer, as well as once it gets into the computer. There's lots of opportunities for subsystems to handle the data. As I mentioned, I don't talk a lot of specifics in this presentation because although we covered a lot, we didn't cover everything. And there is no intent to say this is better than that, just that we found lots of problems that need to be looked at. I didn't think there was any point in telling you what we ultimately ended up with, although I'll freely share that with you, because we were looking for something that worked within our closed system, what would allow us to do the work that we needed to do, and it may or may not translate to any other facility. And most significantly, this is an extremely pervasive problem. In random combinations of hardware and software, we found the failures that I'm going to be showing you to occur greater than 85% of the time. This is a very, very frequent occurrence. And I want to point you to this paper that Chris Lesinek from Audiovisual Preservation Solutions wrote not so long ago that presents this in a different context. So that's a place that you can go for a written copy of something very akin to what I'm speaking about, and I borrowed some of his images along the way. The other disappointment was that I was planning to show some software that we're trying to develop to automate the process. As you'll see as I go through this and describe the process, it's a manual and time-intensive, but it's something I'm convinced that we can automate. But anybody who's been involved with the development of software can appreciate that we're a little behind schedule. There's someone quipped that software engineers spend 50% of their time spend 50% of their time convinced they're 90% finished. Here's an example of the range of hardware that we were testing. Fundamentally, what I was looking to do was to get the data stream, the AES3 data stream, into a computer. That's all I needed to do. On paper, I thought it was a $50 problem to find an interface for that. So we were checking all kinds of hardware. We also looked at a lot of software from extremely simple purpose software like Boom, which only records and won't even play back, to more sophisticated systems across platform. Speaking across platform, we looked at a variety of different operating systems along the way as we went searching for our solution. It took a lot of time along the way looking at drivers, figuring that was a source of some of the problems that we were seeing, and looked at both stock drivers, things that ship with the computers and the software, as well as dedicated drivers that are device-specific. And a wide range of storage options from storage area networks to FireWire and SATA drives. I thought it was important also to mention some of the things that we conspicuously did not test, ranging from iSCSI, which specifically would not work in our configuration because we wanted file, if not block, access universally, everybody have file-level access, to some very fine products that didn't make our test. And this is what we started out doing, is we looked at combinations of computers. We would take the output of a Prism Sound and A to D converter, send it through a switcher, and send the identical signal to multiple computers. In this example, we may have the capital letters would be an operating system, the lowercase letters would be a hardware component, and the digits would be software. And we would take these different combinations, run them through the test, and then tease out what was wrong, what passed, what didn't pass. In looking for a test, we very quickly set aside the idea of listening to the files. Not only is it exceedingly inefficient to sit there and spend, you know, you run a test on six systems on an hour file, and it takes 6 hours to listen through to them and presume that you can hear anything. And it's also very unreliable, because who can remember what they heard in one file versus another file? Software verification, as we found out of the box, has a variety of problems, not the least of which is the limits of its reliability and the range of tests that you can run. And most importantly, it can't certify authenticity. All it can do is tell you that the file is what the file says it is. It can't tell you that the file was what you hoped it would be. So the test process we were using was a null test. We took two presumably identical files, and these files aren't absolutely identical because they're being made on multiple systems, and each one of them is put into record at a different time. So we would take each of the files in pairs, align them to the sample, invert the polarity of one of the files, and then play them back under the assumption that if copy one of the file and copy two of the file contain the same data, then if we subtract one from the other, nothing should come out. Here's a look at the process. This is a screenshot of two stereo pairs, left, right, and we just successively align one pair to the next. As you can see, you just get closer and closer until we get here to the sample level. And then if you watch the bottom pair, we invert one pair, so that when we add the first and third and second and fourth together, nothing should come out. It should be a mathematical null. In this test, we're testing two parameters. We're looking at time, as represented by the number of samples, and amplitude by the number of bits. This is, after all, the way PCM captures sound. So we want 96,000 samples in, we want 96,000 samples out. And we want 16 or 24 bits, and we want them all to match between the two files. I generated this as an example to show you the level of sensitivity in a null test. Our source file is first. I've taken this source file and offset it by one sample, about 10 microseconds. And then run the null test. And the residual is what's in the middle. a true null test is what's on the end, where we have an absolute flat line, in our case, one pixel wide. I want you to take note at this point of the middle one. You'll see that the residual signal is highly correlated to the input signal. Here's a screenshot of a failure. You'll notice on the left-hand side, and this is just one channel, this is a mono instead of a stereo pair we were looking at earlier, all the way to the left-hand side of the screen, you can see that these waveforms line up. In the middle, there is an event. And then over here, they're offset. And this shows us that the offset is 76 samples. Somewhere along the line, 76 samples were dropped. For some reason, we were never able to determine. This was the number of samples that sample loss that we saw most frequently. We have no idea why. We were never able to determine that. You're also unlikely to be able to hear this. This is too small an instance in time that you would hear the loss, even in spoken word or in music, continuous sound like an organ tone. This is too small. Depending on the nature of the event, you might hear a little click, but that's a very small click. This is a picture from Chris Lesinek's paper, where you can see the nature of the problem. This one, I think you probably would hear. Now, if we can assume that we're getting all of our samples through, let's look at the resolution, the bits within the sample. And these are otherwise the same, but you can see there's one bit that's missing in the middle. This is, I think, what people normally are concerned about when looking at bit accuracy in data files in general. This is a very small file, but that's what it looks like in sound. That these two don't match. There is a single bit somewhere in the middle of the sample word that has changed. This also you would not hear. Looking in the amplitude domain, I ran these samples to show the level of sensitivity by taking a file, cloning it. In this case, we do have two absolutely identical files. And when after sample aligning them, changed the gain on one of the files before running the null. In the first example on the far left, the gain changes 1/1000th of a dB. Again, something substantially below the threshold of human hearing. And I kept going because I wanted to see how fine a resolution that I could get. And on the far right-hand side, that's 1/10000th of a dB of difference. And again, as we saw with the sample offset, the residual is highly correlated to the input signal. The signal is modulated. We can tell that there's something there. These numbers in the bottom left-hand corner, I'm going to come back to, those represent the amount of gain reduction from full scale. So that in changing by 1/10000th of a dB, the two signals are differ by 104 decibels. All right. So let's see what happened. We have brand new equipment. We're running through this test. Every single one of the files was failing. It's like complete failure everywhere. This was a really exciting day. So I checked with a friend of mine who's an electrical engineer and knows a lot more about what's going on under the hood than I do, and reviewed our test procedure, and he suggested a few tweaks, but said that fundamentally what we were doing was fine, except that all our files continued to fail the null tests. Then we went back to the old systems that we had been using. These are, at that time, were mostly PCs, a few Macs, configured with in very common ways for the way that audio preservation is done in archives with familiar software, and chronic failure everywhere on these tests. We greatly simplified the tests, and finally were receiving some passes. So this was heartening that we were able to verify at this point that our test procedure appeared to be valid, but we were seeing failures between identically configured systems. You know, computers that we had bought on the same day, same operating system, same software, and we couldn't get null tests to pass between the systems. So we rewound to a much simpler environment. What we decided to do was, rather than do testing across a broad set of systems and to tease out mathematically what was going on in the systems, we needed to go back to basics. We needed to qualify a control. We needed one system that would consistently give us passes that we could then compare other systems to. And very simply, we looked at one parameter. And if we're looking at three systems, the first system doesn't match the second system doesn't match the third system, but the third system does match the third system, then it's the middle system, the second system, that's wrong. This created a new challenge, however, because it assumes that you're only going to change one variable. And given the list, the number of components that exist between the output of the analog to digital converter and the file, there are a lot of places along the way where we had to be able to change just a single configuration. And this was a challenge because, as I just mentioned, identically configured systems wouldn't null against each other. We then looked somewhere else in our facility because another part of our company does new recordings. And we had some hardware and software around that was highly regarded in the system, was known to have been tested for bit accuracy. We had Sonic Solutions. We had Nagra 5 hard disk recorders. And for a variety of reasons, these aren't particularly well-suited to preservation. These are the OS9, the older versions of Sonic systems, where you can't save as a WAV, much less a B-WAV file. And the Nagras are a very simple, self-contained system, but we had control almost over none of the parameters. If it worked, there wasn't going to be operator error going in and changing something. We could change the resolution and the sample rate, but we couldn't adjust any of the drivers or anything else. What the box did, the box did. If it worked, we were in good shape. And suddenly, all of our null tests passed. We recorded to the Nagra and the Sonic Solutions. Every test was always passing, validating our test procedure. This is an interesting note for smaller archives, is the amount of personnel that we had to bring to bear at this. Outside engineers, my head of QA has a physics background. My top engineers were working on this. You know, we have a lot of people at our disposal with strong technical background to run these tests. So I'm feeling for the smaller archives who don't have the resources, and what can we do for them over time to provide them with this level of testing? The other thing we found along the way was tech support from vendors was universally appalling. It was mind-numbingly bad. You get somebody on the phone, they have a short attention span, they have no idea what you're talking about. They wanted to know what menu item you were in. And it was always somebody else's fault. Once we got an actual engineer on the phone who understood what we were talking about, it was a really interesting problem, but, you know, unless his boss is going to tell him to look at this, he's going to move on to something else. In the world of computer coding, there's this concept of a trap, that you write this huge, complicated program, and somewhere buried deep in the code is an intractable problem. And rather than digging back and finding the source of that problem, you build another chunk of code that just looks for that problem to occur. And when it does, you make the right thing happen. It's a pretty efficient solution. It's something desirable, as much as we would philosophically like to see the fundamental problem solved. Going back and solving that one problem may break something else, or any number of things. It's a problem of complex systems. But you can also use traps to mask problems. And early on, I found some things that clearly looked like little crossfades going on. I don't have screenshots for that. But we came upon some other things. This is what a true null looks like. And if you look at the top and top pair and the middle pair, you'll see that the polarity is inverted, and the output signal is this flat line. By comparison, we have this little blip here. And if we zoom in at that, If you can read the time display, this goes on for about 2 seconds, and then it's gone. It comes and goes. This is what an incomplete null looks like. In a different stereo pair, we've nulled them, and we have this residual, which you can see is a whole lot more than even this. If we look at this closer, you can see this display is showing us the resolution from DBFS, decibels of full scale. It's about 90 decibels down. And quite strangely, it's all positive biased. There's nothing below the x-axis there. So we have both a large residual and non-symmetrical output. What we did was I was curious about this, so I took the residual and I normalized it. In normalization, the program will increase the gain to the maximum available resolution, and then gives us a number. It changed the gain by some amount. 1 bit equals about 6 decibels. So if you take that 90 decibels, divide it by 6, we're getting 15 bits of null on a 24-bit word. I zoomed in because I was curious to see what this residual was, and you can see now we see a little fuzziness on this file as we zoom in. And in this area, I've done a Fourier transform, and this is the frequency, the spectral content of the signal. It's broadband noise. It looks to be textbook triangular probability dither, so that the output isn't at all correlated to the input signal. It's noise. It's broadband noise. It's textbook hiss or dither for the signal. So we concluded that not only was the file not passing 24 bits, and not only was it simply not truncating at 16 bits, but they were taking the 16 through the 24th bit and dithering the signal. And if they had simply truncated and padded the files with zeros, that would be a lot easier to find. Somebody might actually notice that. But they are actively acting upon the residual. For some reason, they choose not to pass the 24 bits. Maybe it halves the bandwidth. And they dither the signal. Here, we were testing, trying to find the source of it. We wanted to reduce the load on the system. So we start with 24 bits, reduce it to 20 bits, but for some reason, it's the 16-bit that proves to be too much of a load. And at this point, it drops enough samples, and we get it's only 3 samples get dropped at that point. And then the residual correlates with the input signal. We couldn't find a pattern, but very, very occasionally we would find properly dithered signals. And you can see here's our x-axis here, and there's noise above and below. In these two examples, the residual has been normalized. And here we have signal coming and going, sort of keeps up, doesn't, comes back and forth. Here again is our symmetrical output and a Fourier transform of TPD. Here's a single bit toggling. You know, these are just random screenshots from files, nulls that were going along. There was no systematic. We couldn't. The problems were chronic but not repeatable. This is absolutely positively my favorite example. Although the resolution is higher in this. The display is taller. You'll notice that these two match. That's a true null. That's not a null. Or it's the other way around. This is the null, and this is flatter. This is a funny out. This is when we knew we had a true null because it's an exclusionary case in the math that's generating the normalization. It's normalization of a zero resolution signal. Gave us this funny output that it thought it should turn the signal down in order to normalize it. But what we have here is in the left channel, we have 94 decibels of loss. In the right channel, we have infinite loss because we have a true null. This is in an interleaved pair. So a stereo interleaved file. One of them is passing. This is 15 bits plus dither. And the other is passing 24 bits just fine within a stereo pair. We would see the same hardware. You'd buy the same component, an old version, a new version, and get different results. Run the same configuration. Every time you booted the system, you would get different results. We had one system that would spontaneously sample rate convert the input. And you would run a file, test it, it's fine, run the next file, just hitting record, and it would start sample rate converting. We could never figure out why. You get one set of hardware and change the software, and the results would change so that there's not some setting buried down on a card somewhere that's not behaving. Broadly speaking, we found you get what you pay for. The cheap stuff is burying and hiding any which way it can. The more expensive systems, we were able to get to null tests much quicker. The stock drivers don't work as well as the hardware-specific drivers. I don't think that's a real surprise, but it's worth going through that effort. Non-host-based systems, turnkey systems, behave better than systems that work based on the CPU and the computer. We found Mac-based systems behaved better than PC-based systems. This is not a value judgment, although we're dyed-in-the-wool Mac people. I think it just has something to do with core audio. The operating system knows about audio in a more integrated fashion. But it was true that the bad Mac systems, including some very prominent brands, behaved just as bad as the PC systems. And it's quite clear to us that these systems are very well known because they're actively changing the signal to hide the problem that's going on. So that's what I have to say, and I actually managed to finish within my time window.